Hello, I'm Matt Baum, and welcome to the Sewers of Paris. We're on a podcast search for the entertainment that changed the lives of queer people. On tonight's episode, making love and TV talk shows. My guest this week is Harvey Brownstone, who in 1995 became Canada's first openly gay judge. Focusing his career on family law, Harvey helped shine a spotlight on Canada as a destination for same-sex couples to wed before it was legal in the U.S. But before all that, he was a young gay kid who'd been thrown out of the house, struggling through school, living on welfare, and searching for others like him. We'll have that conversation in a minute. First, I just want to let you know that we're gearing up for the release of my book, Hi Honey, I'm Homo, on May 23rd. It's all about the history of queer characters on sitcoms, and you can pre-order now at gaysitcoms.com. As the book release approaches, there might be a few gaps in the podcast release schedule, but I'm hoping to keep those to a minimum. Thanks for your patience, and thanks to everybody who's pre-ordered already. Now, here's my conversation with Harvey. Well, this week I'm speaking with Harvey Brownstone. Thanks so much for joining me.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Matt. Thanks for inviting me.
So what is the entertainment that changed your life?
I have to say it was a movie called Making Love, which came out in the very early 80s. I had come out as a gay man to my family and been rejected and thrown out. I had spent 5 years living on welfare, trying to get myself through university and law school. I had just graduated as a lawyer, feeling happy that I had come out and that I was living my true authentic self, which in 1980 was not very easy. And then that movie came out, and it was about a married man who realized he was gay and came out. And it really changed my life because it was the first time I had seen such a theme in a movie or a play.
Yeah, boy. You know, strangely, I'm familiar with the movie, but I don't think we've really spoken about it much on the show. So I'm really excited to dive in. For folks who aren't familiar, because it's sort of been lost, it came and went and people don't really talk about it that much anymore, but it's so important. Can you describe for people who aren't familiar what it is?
Well, the movie stars Harry Hamlin and Michael Ontkean. Michael plays a married man in a relationship with Kate Jackson from Charlie's Angels. And they've got a very nice marriage. And then he suddenly comes to terms with the fact that his attraction is really to men. And he meets Harry Hamlin, who is an out gay man. And they have this passionate affair. And he finally tells his wife. What I found really fascinating about this movie is that it bombed at the theaters. Really bombed. In fact, in many small towns, it did not play at all. And then, when videos came out, it skyrocketed. It was the number one rented video for like a year. People were not prepared to be seen going to the theater to see this movie, but they were renting it. And you know who was renting it.
Yeah, yeah.
And that really, really fascinated me.
I can imagine, you know, that video opened up a real opportunity for folks that they didn't have before, especially with it being a new technology around that time. To, you know, be represented and see yourself in a way that just wasn't an option if you were, particularly if you were closeted, which, and is that how, did you see it on video? Is that how it came to you?
No, I lived in a big city and I was out and I went to the theater to see it. I didn't care who saw me. I was a young lawyer at the time. I was a public defender at that time. So I didn't care. I went to the theater. The theater was full of gay men. There was nobody else there but gay men. And it didn't last very long. But I got to tell you that when videos came out, it really changed the life of my generation because we could finally see movies that we'd heard about our whole lives but never got to see unless they were on TV maybe. And they were always cut for commercials. And then suddenly this whole world opened up with videos. And we could buy this VCR machine and you could go and rent these videos. They were too expensive to buy back then, but you could rent them for 24 hours, and suddenly the whole world of all these movies that had come into the world before I was born were available to me, and it really, I just loved it.
And so just to kind of position us in time, how old were you when you saw Making Love?
I was born in 56, so I was like 23, 24.
Okay, yeah. So I can just imagine, you know, I'm kind of thinking about where I was at that age myself and how important it was to see what was I watching around that time? It would have been Priscilla, Queen of the Desert and Trick and those movies that just, you know, my feeling was like, oh, there are others. There are people. There's whole stories. People go through stuff like I'm going through. And it's just such a revelation.
It really is, because for my generation, you know, the 70s were not kind to gay men. The 80s mm-hmm. were even worse because of the AIDS epidemic. But so many of my friends who chose not to come out and mm-hmm. who ended up marrying women and trying to play the game and mm-hmm. not having any success with it and getting themselves into terrible messes really were traumatized by being gay, you know, by having to deal with this decision where you're going to come out or where you're just going to live in the closet. And mm-hmm. I was a very ambitious lawyer. I really, from the first time I went into a courtroom, I knew I wanted to be a judge. I knew mm-hmm. that was where the action was. That's the person that gets the final say. That's the one that gets to make the decisions. But it seemed completely impossible if you were an out gay man. And I remember numerous professors at law school telling me, you know, you're a very good student. It's too bad that you chose to come out because you're not going to get a job and you're not going to go anywhere. So that was my mentality at the time. Mm-hmm. And Making Love, the movie, didn't really help my self-esteem that much because he didn't have a whole lot of success. I think he had success in his personal life having come out, but there was no question in those days, if you were a young professional person, you had to make a decision. If you wanted career success, you had to stay in the closet. And if you wanted personal happiness, then you could come out, but you would sacrifice your career. And I was the first openly gay judge in Canada. Mm-hmm. I had a tremendously successful career as a lawyer. The government made me a judge when I was 38 years old. And so all those people that had told me that I had no hope for any kind of success in my career had to eat their hats when it happened.
Yeah. Can you tell me about your decision to come out initially? Because it sounds like it must have been a really difficult choice.
Well, I was 19 years old. I was an only child. My mom was a Holocaust survivor. This was a big disappointment to them, but I felt that I had to tell them. The truth is, I don't think I realized that they would react the way they did. I knew they'd be upset. I didn't think my mother would become so hysterical that I'd be thrown out. Mm-hmm. I suddenly found myself on the street at 19 years old with no money, no family, all I had was that I'd been accepted into university, but I was very lucky. I got a scholarship. The dean at the university was very sympathetic. And he said, as long as you can get straight A's, we will pay your tuition and your books. Mm. And they got me welfare, which got me a place, you know, I was able to pay for rent. So it was a very unpleasant 5 years to get through university and law school, but I never regretted coming out. I'll tell you, never.
Wow. And where in Canada were you? Like, where are you going to school?
Toronto, and I went to school in a little town called Kingston, not too far from Toronto.
Okay, so at least you had somewhat of a city nearby. So that I imagine was there some amount of gay community that you could find?
Yes, there was a little gay, what they call the gay ghetto. There mm-hmm. were bars, certainly. There was lots of gay nightlife, and there were the bathhouses. But, you know, it was a pretty tough time because if you don't have any money, my main focus was to keep getting straight A's so I could get my school paid for, because I was determined to be a success. I was determined to do something to make my parents proud of me and not be ashamed of me. Mm-hmm. I'll never forget when my mom said to me, when I told her, and she said, "You mean I survived the Holocaust for this?"
Oh.
It was such a powerful moment, and I was determined I was going to be, well, what happened is I became an overachiever, serious overachiever. So I didn't just do well at school. I had to get straight A's. And then when I became a lawyer, that wasn't good enough. I had to be the best lawyer. I never mm-hmm. lost a trial. Mm. And of course, I then got myself appointed to the bench, being the youngest judge in Canada, as well as the first openly gay one. And then that wasn't good enough. I ended up writing a book that became a bestseller. And then I got myself a TV show. And, you know, the thing about rejection from your family is that it makes you an overachiever. It's a tremendous mm-hmm. motivator. I don't recommend it, mm-hmm. but I have to be honest, I don't know what I would have become if I had not had that trauma, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, you know, it's a story that I've heard from a lot of other LGBT folks, is that there's this sort of push to be the very best that, you know, is often quite toxic because it is exhausting and produces a lot of burnout. But it's just very beguiling and hard to resist when you have been rejected in a way that feels so personal, because it's, you know, it is personal. It's about who you are as a person.
Well, you want to compensate. You know, it broke my heart that my mom was just so disappointed in me.
Yeah.
And I wanted to do something. And I knew that if I was a big success out there in the world, in the professional world, that would make her accept me more. And on the day that I became a judge, that was a big, big deal for her. And it made gave me a tremendous amount of validation and gratification. But it is not really what a person should have to do to get parental love and acceptance. I don't want anyone to think that I think this is a good thing. It wasn't, but I'm glad it happened, because truly, and I really mean this, that the rejection I got from my parents ultimately was a great gift.
Wow. I mean, a lot of folks would, I think, carry a lot of bitterness and resentment over it, but it sounds like you've really come to terms with it.
Well, I'm lucky, because we had another 20 years after I became a judge, my parents and I, to heal all that pain. And my parents came a long, long way.
What, during that time, were there things that helped you understand what it meant to be a gay man at that time? Like, did you see representations? You know, you mentioned that movie and other, you know, stuff that you could get on VHS. Like, where did you find depictions of what life would look like for you?
There really wasn't any, especially if you were a young professional. You know, I don't mean to sound stereotypical, but I suppose if you were a performer and you could see people like Elton John and Liberace, there were some role models out there. You know, if you were a decorator or a hairdresser, there were plenty of out people doing that.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't know any gay lawyers. I didn't know anyone in that world. There was nothing in popular culture. Certainly, you know, Will and Grace. Will was, I think, the first gay lawyer that I can think of.
Yeah, I was going to say, I can't think of any before that.
Yeah, there really wasn't. There were no role models for people like me that knew, you know, I knew I was gay and I knew I wanted to build a life with a male partner, but I also wanted to have a really successful career and be accepted in the establishment. You know, I wanted to be wealthy and I wanted to be respected as an accomplished lawyer. I just didn't have any role models. There was nobody on TV. You know, I used television and movies for emotional solace. And like when I was a kid, I was terribly, terribly bullied. I was badly bullied as a kid. And my lifeline was I Love Lucy. Because I knew it played every day on TV at 4:30 p.m. And I knew that if I could get home, if I could just make it home, I could get to watch Lucy at 4:30. And she was my escape. And I felt like she was my friend.
Isn't it strange? You know, that the word escape comes up so often when I'm talking to folks who are, you know, in various, you know, marginalized communities about the power of having media and entertainment and stories to look forward to. Yeah. And it Lucy, you know, certainly is somebody who's come up in my conversations with other gay people. Something about that show really seems to have worked for, you know, maybe it was because she was someone who sort of bucked the patriarchy, even as far back as, you know, mid-century, which not a difficult time, not an easy time to do that. I don't know. Like there's so many gay men who I've spoken to for whom that was their show of choice.
Well, I think there's a very good reason. Lucy was married to someone who was an outcast. He was a Cuban. Mm-hmm. It didn't seem like the typical American family. And number two, Lucy was always trying to break into show business. She was all what she really wanted was to be a star, a performer, but her husband wouldn't let her and tried to make her remain a housewife. And, you know, us gay people, we wanted to be something else too. Mm-hmm. We wanted to be accepted for who we were. We wanted to get to show ourselves as who we really were. And I really identified with that, I have to say. And, you know, like when I was a teenager, All in the Family came out, and your excellent book gives such a great analysis of that show. And for everyone listening, you haven't got the book yet because it hasn't come out yet, but I have read it. I had the great pleasure of having Matt on my show to talk about his book. And the analysis of All in the Family, I can't stress enough, for gay men of my generation, I was a teenager, a young teenager, and Archie Bunker was a bigot, and He was very homophobic. Although, eventually, he got better. But you see, when a closeted gay person would watch All in the Family and see the prevailing attitude and the audience laughing at these jokes about fags, It really, really hurt. It was very hard to watch that because I knew that this is what made people laugh.
Yeah, that, you know, I imagine Archie, you know, comes off, I think, to modern viewers kind of clownishly, but there's a real element of reality, I imagine, especially as if you're watching it as it was broadcast.
Well, and I have to tell you, you know, after I came out, my mother would say, do you know how hard it is when we're out with our friends, when we're out at parties and social events and somebody gives a joke like that and we have to shut up, but we don't dare say anything because we don't want them to know. But Do you know how we feel? That just broke my heart, because had I been there, I would have said something. Mm-hmm. I would have spoken up. I wouldn't have tolerated somebody making a joke that diminished me or anybody else for that matter. But my parents were so humiliated, so ashamed. It's like I came out of the closet and they went in. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a really familiar experience. And you mentioned, you know, that there were figures like Archie Bunker on All in the Family. And, you know, I think one of the reasons that I wanted to write about that in my book was because it was so new that television could even talk about it. It's like television had been in the closet for, you know, the first few decades of its existence, until there were some more daring shows, you know, kind of in the wake of Stonewall and the civil rights movement and all that stuff, that finally was like, oh, no, we're actually going to talk about this. We're going to bring it up, even if it makes you uncomfortable, for better or for worse.
Yes, and it was for better. But if you were the gay person sitting there in a room of people who weren't really supportive, it was a very isolating experience. It wasn't, I cannot tell you that sitting there seeing Norman Lear trying to change public attitudes felt good. It didn't feel good at the time, because I knew that most people would have agreed with Archie.
That's what's amazing about that show, is I think it's very easy, if you are, you know, polarized in one direction or another, to look at a show like All in the Family and be like, well, the intention here is clear. Obviously, I'm supposed to side with this person and against that person. And it's such an interesting Rorschach test for the viewer. Like, whose side do you take says so much about who a person is as they're watching the show.
Yes, yeah, for sure.
Were there, as you came out and, you know, were first a successful lawyer and then later a judge, did you encounter other gay people in the justice system?
Oh, yes, I did. You know, I think I made a point of telling you that I was the first openly gay judge. There were other gays for sure, but they weren't openly gay. And I did certainly have, you know, I got to see the impact that had on people who weren't able to be honest, you know, and it's painful. It's really quite painful. And there are many, many people from my generation who pretty much ruined their lives, their personal lives, in order to have the career they felt they should have, because they didn't think that they could ever do what I did and get where they wanted to go. And saddens me, you know, but you have to listen to that voice inside. You've got to be true to yourself about what's right for you. And I knew what was right for me. It was a gift I think I always had. I always knew what was right for me, just like I always knew that I would one day leave the judiciary and finally host this talk show that I have, because it was something that inside me was telling me that that's what I was really meant to do. And you talk about, you know, I love your book, and I hope you write another book about the impact of talk shows, because I was one of these talk show junkies as a kid. I watched Merv Griffin and Dick Cavett and David Frost and all of these interviewers, Mike Douglas, and they were who I really wanted to be. And none of them were gay. I kind of thought Merv Griffin might be, but certainly nobody ever came out.
Yeah. Wow. Well, tell me about that. Like, what was it about talk shows that drew you in?
You know what I loved, Matt, was that we could see these performers being themselves. I loved it when they were doing their shows, but I wanted to know them. I wanted to kind of penetrate behind the curtain and find out who they really were. So, you know, I was addicted to Carol Burnett. We all were back then. Mm-hmm. I wanted to know what she was really like. And Lucy and all of these big stars. And when they came on talk shows, I would get very frustrated because I didn't think that the host ever asked the right questions. Johnny Carson would drive me nuts because I felt he wasted every interview he ever did. To this day, I don't understand his popularity. I think he was a nice guy and he made the stars feel good, but I don't think he ever gave an interview where at the end of it, you felt like you really knew the celebrity that he was talking to. And I always told myself, one day I'm going to host a talk show and I'm going to actually ask questions that show that I've done my research and that gives the audience a chance to actually get to know who they are. And it just started out as a hobby, really. I never expected it to turn into we're just approaching now 5 million viewers a month. We're on television in the UK. We're about to sign a major network deal in the US and in the UK. Mm-hmm. No one was more surprised by that than me. But I tell you, those talk shows in the 70s were very appealing because if the interviewer was any good, they would reveal something about how they live. What did they like in life? Who were their friends? How did they get where they got? All of that.
Yeah, you know, and what strikes me is, I imagine as a lawyer and as a judge, getting to the crux of an issue and questioning somebody is such an important part of that work as well.
Well, I have had more than one celebrity tell me that they can tell that I spent 40 years in a courtroom because it's true. You know, let's face it, if you watch my show, it's more of an examination in chief than an interview. I don't think it's a cross-examination, at least I hope not, but it's definitely a focused interview with prepared questions that are detailed and designed to strategically get the guest to say something substantive and meaningful. You know, you're not going to see me ask somebody like Barbara Streisand, oh, what was it like working with Robert Redford and The Way We Were? That's just not an interesting question. And the only way that I could get celebrities to come on my show was by proving that I was going to give them an interview that was going to be better than anything they'd ever had. It's a lot of work.
Yeah.
But my courtroom experience, you are 100% right, Matt. That's what did it. That's what makes me different than all of these other podcast hosts because I do my research.
Yeah, well, and you know, I can say as someone who has done a lot of interviews myself that it is difficult sometimes because so often a person will, you know, you ask them a question about something and they'll want to give a polite answer or something that often people are not the best storytellers of their own lives. And, you know, I sort of look at my responsibility to the audience is to guide the guest to the highlights, to the highlights of their own story.
Well, that's a gift you have. You know, that really, you've said a mouthful there. It's true. I can tell you I've had guests on my show who wrote great books, but when they came on the show, honestly, I had trouble believing that they actually wrote the book because they couldn't sell. They didn't know how to market their product, which is their book. Mm-hmm. And they're not good storytellers. It doesn't happen really often, but, you know, or sometimes some people are just boring. And yeah. I hate to say that, but yeah. You know, we've just filmed our 300th show and most of them are pretty well-known celebrities and some are very shy. They're not really good at just talking about themselves. And I have to blame myself for some of this. They weren't expecting an interview that would be in depth. You know, they haven't done their homework. You should never mm-hmm. go on an interview show without checking it out mm-hmm. and finding out who is this person? What is this show all about? What's their interviewing style like? I'm amazed that, you know, I get someone like Robert Redford come on my show. I would have thought before someone in that league, he's a legend, would agree to come on a show like mine, you'd want to know, you know, what's this guy all about? Does he know what he's doing? Who else has he had on the show? But a lot of Hollywood people will come on the show because someone suggested it, but they don't really know much about it. And then I always chuckle to myself when they say at the end, oh, wow, this was amazing. You're the best interviewer I've ever had. I can't believe it. And I'm thinking to myself, well, shouldn't you have known that before you agreed to come on my show?
Right. You know, it's funny because, yeah, sometimes you just take an interview invitation. But I got to say, like, generally, I do like to, if I get an invitation from somebody, to just to know beforehand for no other reason than, like, hopefully you're not walking into some sort of, like, horrible, uncomfortable situation.
Well, I hope you checked me out because I had the great honor of having you come on the show. So I'm so glad you said yes. And you were kind enough to send me your book. I think that book is going to resonate so much with baby boomers like me because you took me not just down memory lane. You gave me insights into shows that I thought I had really understood and absorbed and realized that I had missed stuff. You know, I didn't realize that, let me see, Marcus Welby, a policewoman, I had missed that some of those episodes were really quite offensive. And you opened my eyes in so many ways. I love that book. I think it's going to be a huge success. And I can't wait for you to write another one about the impact that all the talk show hosts had on the American culture, because they did have an impact.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. It means a lot to know that that the book resonated, that it spoke to you.
It sure did.
Can you tell me a little about, you know, your time as a judge? I know that you were involved in a lot of family law and then also with marriage equality when that became a thing in Canada, and we weren't quite there yet in the U.S. What was that time like for you?
You know, I have to tell you, Matt, thank you for asking that question. I did family law and I did criminal law, and I was really very concerned about same-sex marriage when it started to be litigated, because I was worried that the judges who were going to have to decide these things really didn't get it. You know, when you're in a courtroom, that's not the easiest way to convey to the judges that same-sex marriage is ultimately, when you peel away all of the other things that attach to the status of being married, it's really about love, and it's about two men or two women feeling that they are equal as every other relationship. And so I made it, now that I'm not a judge anymore, I can say this, and this is the first time I'm saying this publicly, I made a point of getting to know the judges that I thought would have the most influence in these cases. And I invited them to my home, and I wanted them to see me and my partner. And I was always so gratified when judges would say to me, you know, this is the first openly gay couple that I've ever spent time with. I really didn't know any. So behind the scenes, I was very involved just making sure they understood who gay people are. I had a number of judge colleagues who came to me and said that one of their kids had come out and they were having difficulty dealing with it. And it was really a great honor. I felt very grateful and humbled that these colleagues were prepared to come to me and ask me to help them deal with their children coming out. So that's how it started. And then when the decision was made in 2003, the Ontario Court of Appeal here in Canada decided to legalize same-sex marriage and to make it immediate. You know, Matt, the internet in 2003 was not what it is now. So you're not going to believe this, but I got a phone call from somebody in the gay community that said, would you be willing to do same-sex marriages? Because now it's legal. We're getting a lot of requests, people that want to come up here and get married, and they don't really know where to go. I said, sure. And he said to me, well, how can they reach you? And I said, well, here's my email address. Just give it out, and people can contact me, and I'll find a time during my day here at the courthouse to do these weddings. Well, within a week, I received 8,000 emails, and it blew the server at the courthouse.
Gosh.
No one predicted the demand, mostly from Americans, but lots of Canadians too, and Europeans, to come to Toronto and get married. In fact, Out Magazine said that Toronto was the number one travel destination between 2003 and 2006 or 7, until it really took off in the States. They were all coming to Toronto to get married, and I was the only judge making himself publicly available to do these weddings. Mm-hmm. You know, and a lot of gay couples did not want to go to a church because it wasn't the churches that gave us our rights, and it wasn't the government that gave us our rights, it was the courts. And they really wanted to be married in a court. And of course, they could have gone to City Hall, but I ended up doing well over 2,000 same-sex marriages in those first few years. I would do five a day, one before court, one during morning recess, one at lunch, one in the afternoon recess, and one right after court. Five a day. And I got to meet so many wonderful same-sex couples from the States. I made many friends. And it was really, I mean, can you imagine how surreal that was? Did I ever think that I would get to officiate at a same-sex wedding? I mean, I remember officiating at straight weddings, and it felt very surreal that here I was bestowing the status of marriage on these straight couples, but I wasn't allowed to have it myself. I can't even explain how surreal that was.
Yeah. Oh, well, I absolutely can understand the, you're sort of a representative of this system that you can just see the injustice as it applies to you personally. That must have been so strange.
It was. And I must tell you that when you're working in family court, you see nothing happy. I mean, other than adoptions, those are always happy, but certainly you're dealing with couples that are breaking up. That was the bread and butter of my day. And they were terrible custody disputes and visitation and child support and, you know, and child protection cases with neglected and abused children. Family court is not a happy place. And yet I was doing these weddings, five a day, which were such joy. These couples that wanted to be together. I had couples come from Russia, from countries where, from Arab countries, Muslim countries, where these people were risking their lives. I'll never forget a couple I had from Turkey, two men who had come to Toronto just to get married. They couldn't believe they were standing in front of a real judge getting married. And they at the end, I said, they just stood there and I said, you know, you can kiss each other. And they couldn't believe that they were going to be allowed to kiss in front of somebody. I'll never, ever forget that privilege I had to not only represent the country of Canada and the judiciary, because let's face it, we were ahead of the ballgame. We were one of the first countries to have same-sex marriage. I was very, very proud to be a gay judge doing it. It was really a very special time in my career.
And what a shift from the atmosphere when you were just getting into school and starting your career, when so much of queer life was about concealment and hiding and, you know, feeling as though you were the only one there to be so public about it must have been, you know, quite a unique position for you to be in.
I guess it was, you know, one day somebody called me and said, did you know you have a page on Wikipedia? And I think I almost fainted. I couldn't believe. I don't know where they got all that information. It was quite something. And I'll tell you something else that was really hard as a judge when I started. In criminal court, I would see so many gay men getting arrested for having sex in public places, public washrooms, or in a park or something. And of course, they were all married. They were all doing this, you know, hiding. And it really, really broke my heart to see what this was doing to them, that to have been charged. And in those days, the police would publish the names of the people who had been arrested for these, you know, so-called indecent acts. And it was, I would like to think that as a judge, while following the law as best I could, let me just say that I did what I thought was right in those cases. And I will leave it at that.
Yeah. Yeah. Gosh, and what a obviously different time when folks had very limited options for, you know, how they could meet and express themselves, and you know, their conditions, you know, obviously were super different from how they are now.
Well, and I really like that you care, because you're younger than me, and I feel that the younger generation of gay in the gay community don't care about our history, about what those of us from my generation went through, you know, the barriers that we broke down and the obstacles we overcame so that you guys could have a better life. I really don't think that our community is very good at institutional memory, so to speak. Mm. Is that the right term?
I think so. Yeah. It's something that really surprises me is how little of that is in just the, you know, as someone I in my work here in Seattle, I report a lot on infrastructure, and you know, one of my other kind of strange interests is city planning and streets and all that kind of stuff. Very, very distant from my marriage work and my, you know, pop culture stuff. Anyway, Chicago and San Francisco, I think, have done a really nice job of creating monuments and walks and plaques where you can see just in your daily life. It's very difficult to avoid seeing the history in your home. And a lot of cities just don't do that, or it gets demolished or goes away. And, you know, people hold those stories, but I hate to say it, people don't last forever. And capturing that, the details of what came before a group of people, you know, that we have such comfort in our lives now is because of the work that people of your generation before did to ensure that we could live as comfortably as we do.
Well, thank you for saying that, Matt. It means a lot to me. I do feel sometimes that our generation and those before me are forgotten. I am writing a book. I'm calling it Homo Improvement.
Mm, that's great.
And I don't know if anyone will care, you know, but it's not like I'm spending a lot of my own time really preserving gay history, because I'm doing something very different. I'm interviewing celebrities, but I don't get the chance to talk about this very often. So I'm very grateful that you gave me that avenue.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's something that I really want to bring to life, because, you know, the folks who, you know, going back on occasion, I have the privilege to have an opportunity to, you know, go back even further to, you know, 100, 200 years to what life for, you know, either gender nonconforming or same-sex attracted, whatever terms you want to use back then, because obviously terminology has changed. Just to, you know, the further back in history I go, the more I see these are just folks. You know, you could talk about, you know, Alexander the Great, for example. You know, there are elements of stories going back hundreds, thousands of years where, you know, it's so easy to find that a touch point in a person's life, you know, reading their biography, when I feel like, oh, this is just somebody I could have known as a friend. Maybe not Alexander the Great, but you know, I read about you know, somebody who was living on the frontier in the 1800s and, you know, had a partnership with, you know, two men who had a partnership, or, you know, someone who was, you know, presented as a man, and it was only after their death that people realized that there was more to their story and their gender. You know, it's so often do I find myself thinking, boy, I just could have known that person. That could be somebody that I'm friends with today. You know, these are just folks who make history, and they could be our friends, and also the people that are around us today are, you know, folks who could be called upon, or often have been called upon to make history in their own lives.
Well, you know, and since we're talking about pop culture, you know, I think it's very important to point out that, you know, the people that we saw on television when people of my generation were growing up, you know, I chuckle when I hear people say, oh, well, you know, there were drag queens back then. There was the movie Some Like It Hot, and there was Milton Berle. He was always in drag.
Oh, gee.
And there was Flip Wilson. He played this drag character. Yeah, but every one of those celebrities went out of their way to make sure the public knew they were straight. There was never any question. Mm-hmm. And then when you looked at people that everyone knew was gay, Liberace was extremely flamboyant, mm-hmm. you know, and Elton John, when he finally came out, because he first married a woman, but then he finally came out, mm-hmm. he was also extremely flamboyant. And while that was great that we knew they were gay, you couldn't identify with them if you weren't flamboyant. In fact, yeah. I distinctly remember saying to myself, well, if that's what gay is, if Liberace is what gay is, maybe I'm not. Because mm-hmm. I have no desire to walk around wearing a feather boa mm-hmm. and using the word fabulous in every third word of sure, every sentence. Yeah. So maybe I'm not. So, you know, it is important people understand that although those figures were definitely significant in the evolution of the perception of gay people on television, they also had a difficult impact on everybody else who didn't relate to that. Mm. And that's why the one episode of All in the Family that you wrote about, where there's a fellow in a bar who surprises Archie by saying that he's gay because mm-hmm. he's such a regular guy, such a straight acting macho guy.
Right.
That was very significant because that person was more like the gay men that I ended up growing up knowing mm-hmm. than Liberace.
Right. Yeah. I think you're right. That's one of the things that was so groundbreaking there is that there was so much camp and stereotype on television and film at the time that the idea of, oh, this guy's a former baseball player, a football player, and he's tall and macho and muscular. How could it possibly, you know, and it ends with Archie saying, you know, the character Steve punches Archie on the arm as he's walking out, you know, friendly, just like, see you later, Arch, and punches him on the arm and kind of knocks Archie to the side. And Archie shakes his head and thinks about the rumors that he's heard about this character. And he says, well, if that's the punch of a fruit. And then the camera zooms in and you can see him considering. It just trails off with that thought. And you can see Archie considering, if that's the punch of a fruit, dot, 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 then that means, you know, and it's such a wonderful moment to be like, we're everywhere. We're all around. There are many ways that we can live our lives in as many ways as anybody else can live their lives. A rare consideration that, you know, there certainly are the hairdressers and the interior decorators and, you know, the flouncers, and God bless them. They're wonderful. But that's there's more to our stories than that.
Yeah. And when we watch TV, I don't know about now, because I think there's so many other avenues of expression. There's just so many channels and platforms. But back then, we were looking for some kind of reflection of who we were. Mm. And we didn't find it. So TV became the escape. And you lost yourself in the comedy and in the stories and in your affection for the particular stars. You know, so when we saw Harvey Korman being very effeminate in some skit on the Carol Burnett show, we mm-hmm. laughed to ourselves, you know, but we didn't see ourselves reflected very much. And when you grow up with no role models, in a way, it's liberating because you don't have anyone to pattern yourself after. So you just decide to be yourself. At mm-hmm. least for me, I don't really think that it's such a big accomplishment to decide to just be yourself. But I have to say, there must be something to it because so few people did it back then.
Yeah.
And I'll never understand what gave me the strength to do it, mm-hmm. you know, but I'm glad that I did.
Well, so tell me about the work that you're doing now. You retired from the, you know, being a judge, and now you're creating media and putting more stories in front of audiences. What was behind the decision to do that? And tell me about what it is that you fill your day with these days.
Well, as I mentioned, I was always one of these talk show junkies. I never missed Larry King and mm-hmm. Inside the Actor's Studio and all of these interview shows. And I have to say, this is not very humble of me, but really, I would say to myself, I could have done better. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'm just going to say it. I know that Oprah's interview with Harry and Meghan was the most watched interview last year. I'm telling you, Matt, I could have done better. Uh-huh. And so I always told myself that I would, when I retired, I would have a hobby. And that started as a hobby. I just thought, well, you know, the pandemic was on and Zoom was now in existence. So I thought I would see if I could get anybody famous to talk to me. Mm-hmm. I just figured I would try it. So I, you know, there are websites you can go to where you can get the email addresses and names of the personal representatives of pretty much any celebrity. And I would write these emails saying, hi, I'm a judge, because at that time I still was a judge. I started the show a year before I left the judiciary because I wanted to retire with something on the go, something to do. And so I'd say, hi, I'm a judge, and I would really love to interview your client. I'm a big fan, blah, blah, blah. And over the course of a few months, little by little, celebrities started saying yes. And so I kept doing it. And then I would see on YouTube, because that's where I put the show. There's a website and they have a YouTube channel. The numbers started growing, like really growing. And then I would start getting more and more people saying yes. After about 6 months, we had 1 million viewers. And then I suddenly found it easier and easier and easier to get people to say yes. And then some celebrities would say, listen, how would you like to interview so-and-so? They're a really good friend of mine. And I'd say, sure. Oh, yes, for sure. So after about a year, we had 3 million viewers. And then a management company in Hollywood contacted me and said, listen, there's nobody doing what you're doing. There's nobody giving these kinds of interviews with celebrities. Can we manage you? We think you should be on TV. I said, well, sure, go ahead. So I kept going and the word kept spreading. And then I think now we're at 4.8 or 4.9 million. I think we're going to hit 5 million this month. And now we get celebrities coming to us saying, you know, I got a movie coming out. Can we be on your show? About a year ago, I was approached by a TV network in the UK saying, you've got a huge audience here. We want to put you on TV. Can we do it? I said, sure. You just pick the shows you want and you can air them. So that started happening. Then my management company my managers in LA, Rick and Robin, they began negotiating with some TV networks. And so it just kept growing and it's become a full-time job, because the thing about doing research, as you know, you can't fake a good interview. You have to have the facts. You have to have the knowledge. You can't be asking them about this movie or this TV show or that TV show or something about their life unless you know exactly what you're talking about. So I spend hours and hours and hours doing my research. And that, I think, is the reason why the show took off, because people want interviews that are going to be revealing something. There's going to be a wow moment. I mean, I've had, you know, Tony Orlando broke down and cried. You know, Robert Wagner, who's 93 years old and hasn't given an interview in years, came on my show and really opened up about his life and his career. And I'm very grateful, very honored. You know, Tony Tennille has been retired for quite a while. I love the Captain and Tennille. I was thrilled when she came on. And we've had so many big stars. So that's what I spend my time now. I thought it was a hobby, but it turned into a big operation now.
What do you want folks to come away from your show with? Like, what kind of understanding or what do you want them to feel when they watch?
I want them to feel, number one, that their time was well spent. That if they're a fan of this person, they got to really get a real glimpse into who they really are. But a lot of my shows are not with famous people. Like you, you're not a household name, but you wrote a book that deserves being promoted. And I love, I would say maybe a third of my interviews are with authors who've written really great books that I think deserve the promotion. So I want people to come away from those interviews with the desire to buy the book, to read the book.
Well, I'm certainly very appreciative. I'm very grateful to you for reaching out to me.
Well, you know what's been really great?
Yeah.
I'm very proud of this, Matt. Every author that's come on our show has seen their book go to number one in its category on Amazon within 7 days of the interview being released.
Wow. Okay. That's something to look forward to. I certainly hope I don't break the streak.
And you know why, Matt?
Why is
I figured it out. Okay. My YouTube analytics tell me who's watching. And my audience is 75% baby boomers. And the thing about baby boomers is that they read books. They buy books and they read books. They have the attention span to sit through an interview that might be an hour long. And unfortunately, the younger crowd don't have the attention span. They will not sit through a long interview, but baby boomers will. And your book, I think, it's really a very entertaining book for people from my generation, because we grew up watching those shows.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, I think I'm hopefully hitting a sweet spot with your audience with the topics that I'm talking about.
For sure,
Barney Miller and Bewitched, and
Alice. hit a double whammy with my audience, because I also have a very large gay audience, and your book is about the representation of gays on TV. So you hit the baby boomers and the gays with my platform.
Fantastic. Well, I'm happy to do it. I feel as though I'm in good company there. So I'm really excited about it and appreciative. I want to, you know, we've been chatting away so much here, and we're coming up on time, but I do want to ask you, you know, when you look back at the work that you're putting out now, the conversations that you have and the audience that you're speaking to, folks who are around your, you know, grew up around the same time as you and often have the same background, or, you know, who are other LGBTQ folks, you know, looking back to when you were just coming up and realizing that you were gay and getting into, you know, adulthood, is it possible to look back on that and think, you know, what it would have meant for the young you to have a show like what you are producing now?
Oh, I think it would have been very meaningful, because if there had been an interviewer like me when I was growing up and trying to find my own identity, that interviewer would have asked key questions that would have opened up the person's soul. And I learned from that. You know, I would have learned, because the thing about being young, if you have any ambition at all, if you are driven, if you want success and you're young and you have to do it on your own, because there's nobody in your family that's going to hand you a career, there's no family business to go into, then really what you want to do is see other successful people and figure out how they made it. That's what I did when I was in my early 20s. I shadowed other lawyers. I asked if I could junior on a trial with them for free. I just wanted to find out, how did they do it? What made them tick? And interviewers, if you're a good interviewer like you and me, we can get people to explain what makes them tick. You know, we have, you know, Andrew Lloyd Webber, of course. I'm sure you know him.
Sure, sure. Not personally, well, but I know of him.
His writing partner, Tim Rice, is coming on our show April 1st.
Wow, that's a great get. Congratulations.
Yeah, well, it was quite an honor, actually. He asked me.
Wow.
He saw my interview with Peter Noon from Herman's Hermits. Anyway, if someone were aspiring to write lyrics, you know, or to write for musical theater, I guarantee you that that interview will help them, because I'm going to ask him questions that are going to try to delve into, you know, where does your creativity come from? Where did your resilience come from? That's what I think a good interviewer should do. And I think that if you do that, it's not going to appeal to everyone. You can't appeal to everyone. But you can attract your audience. There is a niche out there for what you do and for what I do. And I think that, you know, even though there's millions of podcasts out there, and most of them are really quite amateurish and very unfocused and a waste of time, and I'm sorry to say that, but it's true. But if you find ones that have been well thought out, you can really learn a lot. I enjoy it.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, it's a real privilege to be able to speak to an audience that appreciates what you're doing. I think that's something that I certainly value is the folks who enjoy the stuff that I'm making. And I'm sure that it's the same for you, that to know that there are folks out there who are like grateful or are receptive to the work that you're doing is extremely motivating.
It really is. It's quite a privilege to have people listening. I'm always extremely touched when I see the comments on YouTube and Facebook and Instagram and on our website that people send me notes. And I'm very touched, because it means that what I did was worthwhile. You know, I only did it really for me as a hobby, but it became worthwhile, you know. And there's so much about these famous people that you can identify with, you know. I'll give you an example. Yesterday we had, do you remember a show on TV, Dr. Quinn, Medicine Woman?
Oh, yeah, of course.
Well, the man who played her husband, Joe Lando, he was on my show yesterday. And we talked very frankly about what it was like to go from being a sex symbol. He was, after all, People magazine said he was one of the 50 most beautiful people in the world in the 80s.
No pressure.
You know, he was pretty much marketed as quite the hunk on that show. And in fact, I'm trying to remember if I ever saw him with a shirt on the whole time he was on that show. And now he's in his 60s and he's had to reinvent himself as a different kind of actor. And there were moments in that interview where you could see that this is really hard. These famous people have challenges that most of us can't even imagine. Yeah. But every once in a while, you find yourself identifying. You know, not that I could really compare it, but when I stopped being a judge, it was an adjustment. You know, I'm not anybody important anymore. I'm a nobody now. Nobody's going to stand when I enter the room. And I don't, you have to find some way to still be relevant. And if you're a gay person like me from my generation, you know, we didn't have children. We were too old. By the time the law changed to allow us to be parents, we were too old for all that. So I don't have a family. Yeah. I have to have something to do and keep busy and keep myself relevant. And I really feel that whatever you do, you know, not everybody wants to have a podcast, but you have to find a way to keep yourself interested and engaged. And I'm just so lucky that I found this and that through this, I got to meet wonderful people like you. And and you here you are kind enough to ask me to come on your show, which was a total bonus. I'm just very, very grateful, Matt, really.
Oh, well, I'm very grateful too. I'm really glad that we had this opportunity to for me to visit you and for you to visit me. And for folks to, you know, for my listeners who want to check out what you're doing, where should they go?
Well, there's the Harvey Brownstone Interviews channel on YouTube. There's the harveybrownstoneinterviews.com website. That's really where you'll see our show. If you're in the UK, we're on XPTV1, the XPTV1 network in the UK. I can't say too much more at the moment, but we will have, we will be visible in much bigger places very soon.
That's very exciting. Congratulations. And thanks again so much for chatting with me and for all the great work that you do. It's greatly, greatly appreciated.
Well, thank you for your books, for your show, for your heart. And I can't wait to promote the next book you write.
Thank you so much. I better get to work. Thanks, Harvey. Thanks again so much for chatting with me. It's really, really been a pleasure.
It's been, the pleasure's been all mine. Thank you so much, Matt.
Thanks to Harvey for joining me, and thanks to everybody who makes The Sewers of Paris possible on Patreon. Head over to patreon.com/MattBaum to support the show and get backer rewards. Check out my upcoming book, Hi Honey, I'm Homo, for a history of queer characters on American sitcoms. Visit my YouTube channel for stories from behind the scenes of iconic pop culture. And keep up with even more of my work through my weekly newsletter. You can find all that and more at MattBaum.com. The theme song for The Sewers of Paris is Parisian from filmmusic.io by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 4.0. And until next time, croissant.